welcome everyone to, we've got a bit of a special edition of the podcast going on here. We're going to release it in sequence, but this was not one that we had planned to do when we put our initial podcast schedule together back in January. However, circumstances being what they are, we have a lot of free time on our hands hanging out around the houses these days where we normally record these podcasts remotely anyway. But two, we have a pretty significant topical tie-in, and to that end, we have a special guest today. Joining us is Rex Brynan from up in Canada, up north of the wall there. And Rex, we brought you in because I really need to know, was this just pure dumb circumstantial luck, or are you far more prescient than anybody gave you credit for in scheduling a mega game about a global pandemic outbreak?
Well, it was just a coincidence. I mean, it was a somewhat different pandemic outbreak. It was the zombie apocalypse, but there was still a virus, and all the things involved in that. No, I mean, we ran Apocalypse North. We ran it last year at McGill, and we just ran it earlier this month at the Canadian government's former nuclear war command bunker in Carp, just outside Ottawa, which is a truly the most awesome place to run a mega game. I mean, they essentially let us take over half the bunker, use all the facilities, the PA, everything. We ran it again because we made the game up. We didn't want to put all, you know, all the materials to bed without running the game again. That game, I mean, mega games are not meant to be super serious games. We run them for fun. I think at McGill University, we run one each year. It's a bit different in the sense that it tends to be a little more serious topic and a little cooperative, because I kind of, it's not the reason we run it, but I do integrate it into my teaching stuff as well. So Apocalypse North, which had as its inspiration originally Jim Wallman's Urban Nightmare series of games, was a fairly serious game about what you would do about zombie apocalypse. And it was designed really to be an infection control game. So you get zombies, but what you also get is a lot of infected American refugees trying to get into Canada, and you have to do quarantine. You have to do screening. We had screening. You have to do quarantine. You've got to deal with the impact on essential services.
I thought you were trying to convince us this wasn't realistic.
We had the Public Health Agency of Canada. We had the World Health Organization. We had the CDC in a way in the game as well. So there was an entire, you've got to sequence the virus. You've got to do vaccine trials. You've got to work on treatment protocols. We had hospital systems modeled, and so on and so forth. So it was not far from that sense. And certainly the issues of what is a federal responsibility, what is a provincial responsibility, you know, how do you get local first responders and the federal government to respond? I mean, the one big difference is that game involved Canadian forces units going to war with hordes of zombies, but some of the emergency management stuff underlying it has a lot of parallels with what's happening right now.
Yeah, so you did a dress rehearsal 2 years ago, and then you decided to come back and do it again just to make sure the plan was good.
Yeah, a year ago was in fact the big one, because that was 100 odd people at McGill. The one in Ottawa that we had this month was a smaller version of it with 50 people. This year at McGill, we did another emergency management drill, but that was kind of kaiju giant monsters coming out of the Atlantic, called Atlantic Rim. So we didn't have an infection component to it, but it was an emergency management game. And then even more coincidentally, in the beginning of December, I got a kind of emergency call from Agriculture Canada to do pandemic gaming, not around COVID-19, but around something that's even more lethal and dangerous if you're a pig, and that's African swine fever. So I, in fact, spent the Christmas break into early January designing and delivering a game to help them with actual pandemic preparedness. So, you know, they were using that game to stress test their plans for African swine fever. So that was, you know, that was my first major serious foray into pandemic gaming. And it was a really interesting experience. It was a terrific partner to work with.
We'll come back to the one of the African swine fever here in just a second, but for folks who may have heard or seen the term mega game, can you give us a synopsis of what obviously the name itself implies a big production with lots of folks. I've seen discussions of it online. I've seen pictures and after action reports and would love to get a chance to participate in one sometime. But for our listeners who may have no idea what the heck a mega game is, give us the synopsis of what a mega game is, not necessarily specific to these.
So a mega game involves, as the name suggests, a lot of people, usually 30 plus. We have over 100 usually at ours at McGill. You're looking at relatively simple game rules, usually a series of sub-games that are all interconnected, running by a control team that could be 10 to 20 people. It's a bit of role-playing, it's a bit of a negotiation game, it's a bit of a map game, sort of classic war game stuff, and it's a lot of chaos because you're usually playing over about 7 hours with, about 30 minutes per turn. You don't stop. I mean, we don't stop for lunch or anything. It's absolutely continuous. So people are running around and they're having to do, things in coalition. In some mega games, there's a lot of backstabbing. Obviously less of that in a pandemic, preparedness emergency management, game. To envisage what we have at McGill, at least we ran an entire floor of what used to be a hotel. It's now a McGill residence. So we have a ballroom and some breakout rooms. We have some tactical maps, which any war gamer would recognize. So in the full game, we have maps of Southern Quebec, the Niagara Peninsula area, and the Detroit-Windsor area with zonal movement, area movement, combat units with, CRTs and a certain amount of resilience and movement points and all that stuff that they would recognize. Zombies that can be fought, but there's also an awful lot going on. So there was a science subgame in which people were having nothing to do with that. They were having to go through the steps of developing a vaccine. They were having to get virus samples. They were having to sequence them. They were having to cooperate. They were having to work on a vaccine. So there's a science game. There's an entire political game. If you're a federal or provincial cabinet minister, you're not moving stuff on a map. You're dealing with the overall crisis. We have a lot of chain of command. So, all the way from the prime minister and the cabinet, the chief of defense staff, divisional commanders, brigade commanders, and we try and keep that proper chain of command. So information is flowing up and orders are flowing down. We had the private sector involved, so not too seriously in the game. The Tim Hortons donut chain, which anyone who knows Canada will know. We have a lot of Tim Hortons. They had to keep their stores open, which we had marked on the map, but they also were a secret zombie fighting organization. But we had a private sector. In the full U.S. game, we had American refugees. So we had someone playing the American embassy. We had someone playing the commanders of American military units that had fled to Canada, which became complicated because what is the protocol under which they can use lethal force in Canada against infected Canadian citizens? And there's a lot of complex moral, political issues there. We had a bunch of university students up from MIT who played American refugees. So they were just desperately trying to survive and not get eaten and occasionally rioting or looting stores if they felt they weren't otherwise being taken care of. We had an American survivalist commander whose purpose was to try and take over the Bruce Peninsula nuclear power station and declare a new society. So we had sort of spoilers, quasi-insurgent, and they're all doing slightly different things, and all these parts are moving together. So the combat game is going to affect the medical game because you actually have to retrieve casualties on the map and bring them to hospitals and then run them to the hospital game. One of the things that happens in the hospital games are autopsies and things that inform the science game. The science games are also going to be affected by the cabinet having to make financial decisions about where money goes. Does money go for scientific research? Does it go for overtime for the RCMP? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a bunch of interlocked games. None of them is entirely separate, and a lot of chaos. So a lot of, even though there were rules and any war gamer would recognize the combat rules, there's a lot of stuff that's, as they say of experimental drugs, off-label. People try things.
Yeah.
We don't have a rule for it yet, and control saying, oh, that's a good idea. We think you could do that, or we think you couldn't do that, or them thinking of things that we didn't have an existing rule for. So how many refugees can you move by Royal Canadian Air Force airlift out of Windsor, Ontario? One of the big findings of the game is you don't want to live in Windsor, Ontario, because a lot of stuff comes across from Detroit.
Yeah.
Poor Windsor ends up being this desperately besieged city with zombies everywhere.
Totally off topic. I always loved the lyric from Journey about somebody born and raised in South Detroit. I'm like, that's Windsor, Ontario. Like, that's not even in the U.S. when I first moved out of South Carolina and I was in Ohio in grad school, one of my National Guard training summers, we went up to Camp Grayling in Michigan, and I was sending an email back to some friends. How far north am I? I can drive south into Canada. So the
well, we usually have, because we run this, the McGill one, we run the day after the Connections North Serious Wargaming Conference. We always have quite a few folks from U.S. Army War College or Naval War College or wherever you hanging around. So I must admit, I did customize some of the refugee American military units to be units that people had previously been involved in earlier in their military careers.
Well, there you go. Give them a connection to it. For folks that may have it as a frame of reference, can you offer a comparison between the Mega Game and like the NSDM guys?
Yeah, I mean, the Mega Game has more going on in terms of, I think, subject matter. Okay, so, I mean, there are Mega Games which are almost entirely built around kinetic military campaigns, in which a much larger proportion of the game is a conventional war game. So Ottawa Mega Game Groups ran Ben Moore's Iran-Iraq War game last year. And most of that, there's a political too, but most of that is a very conventional war game, you know, with divisional commanders and army commanders and, you know, all arms stuff and so on and so forth. So you can run mega games that are going to quite a bit like the NSDM stuff. Obviously, my political scientists, the games I tend to run tend to be very poll mill, in which more than half are going to be political roles or non-military, non-kinetic first responders. So when I run them, yeah, the Canadian forces are there, but there may be a third or a quarter of the game, and you know, there's first responders, there's mayors, there's provincial officials, there's federal officials. There's a lot of stuff going on that's not combat. So that's probably the biggest difference. But a mega game could look very much like what they're doing. People in the mega gaming community argue about what a mega game is, much like people in the wargaming community argue what a war game is. It's really broad. It's a bunch of people, and it tends to have a semi-rigid Kriegsspiel in that there are written rules, but an awful lot of stuff is going to be umpire adjudicated or modified on the fly.
Yeah, so it's probably the role-playing influence there of, well, the rules say this, but it's a better story if we ignore it and do this other thing, huh?
Yeah, and we get into, you know, there's a little bit of a LARP component. So, you know, our medical staff showed up at the game wearing, you know, face splatter shields and scrubs or lab coats or what have you. During the Iran-Iraq game, every time, I was Ayatollah Khomeini, but every time Tehran got bombed by the Iraqi Air Force or missiles, we would sound an alert and all sit under the table for a minute until the, so you know, so it's somewhat silly getting in the run of things, you know, the momentum of things. One of my favorite mechanisms actually is when we run the mega games, I always put a little personal agenda item in each player's briefing. It could be anything, you know, be the most popular mayor, be excessively nice to everyone, you know, take selfies. My favorite is I seed the game with about 10 envelopes that say, at some point in the game, shout out, oh God, we're all going to die. And then I have about 10 envelopes that say, if anyone panics, shout out, good God, man, or good God, woman, get a hold of yourself. So we'll be playing the game, and there's 120 people in this ballroom running around, and someone will suddenly shout out, oh God, we're all going to die. And then you'll hear 5, 6, 7 people shouting from different parts of the room, good God, man, get a hold of yourself. It's quite a funny game mechanism.
That sounds delightfully wacky.
Yeah. There is a certain amount of wackiness in most mega games. They don't have to be. We had a whole crew up from the U.S. Army War College to look at the mega game this year and see how they could use it for their own kind of civil military cooperation, emergency management gaming. So, you know, you don't have to do that, but we're running it for fun. We're not running it as a serious game.
Obviously, it could be adapted as a serious game, though. I mean,
absolutely. I mean, there was most of the game was serious. So the game we ran, the main game we ran this year in February, which was Atlantic Rim, which was this mysterious meteors hit the Atlantic coast of North America. Horrible monsters come out of the sea. Giant lobsters, sea slug, seagulls, a giant fish we call Godzilla. That game, you know, it had kaiju, it was like a Godzilla movie, but we also modeled the entire Atlantic Canada electrical grid. you know, accurate, like where the high voltage transmission lines ran, where the generator capacity was, what kind of generators they were. Yeah, it was a game with giant seagulls and a rampaging angry crustacean or rock lobster. But part of that game was people running around and trying to keep the actual electrical grid running, in which every single power plant in Atlantic Canada was part of the game and was modeled for its actual electrical production capability. And you had to move your energy along the grid to the right places.
Does Atlantic Canada know that you had their stuff mapped in that great of detail?
No, not unless they read the report on Pax Sims. There was one terrible moment. I mean, one cardinal rule, I think, of a mega game is if there's a nuclear power plant on the map, it probably means something. And we have one in New Brunswick. And never allow a lobster that feeds off of electricity to reach an unguarded nuclear power plant. That's you know, just
basic. It's right up there with never start a land war in Asia and don't go in against the Sicilian when death is on the line.
Large and powerful lobster. So that happened.
Yeah. The mega games, multiple interlocking games, lots of interpersonal role play as a part of it. Some goofiness in the scenarios when you're just having fun with them, but ability to turn serious as needed.
Yeah, I mean, just to make a point about how you can do that, we're actually in discussion with First Canadian Field Hospital, so the Canadian Forces Deployable Field Hospital, to put them in the next game, so that they can run an actual serious field hospital management game as a sub game in a somewhat less serious mega game. So absolutely, could you make it 100% serious? Wouldn't actually require much modification. You could use a zombie scenario. You could use something else. Zombies are actually pretty good. There's a reason why they often get used for these kinds of things, because they test everything from, you know, to law and order security issues through to medical issues, through refugee issues, critical infrastructure maintenance issues, and so on and so forth. So absolutely it could be used for a serious game.
So it sounds like you're just saying that the zombies are cover for a serious rehearsal for, you know, a major civil outbreak.
Yeah, no, someone said, I want to, you know, I got a National Guard unit, and we got a sort of training day on a Saturday, and could you run a game that would be useful for teaching our personnel about the kinds of issues they're going to run into in the kind of current pandemic we have right now? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, COVID-19 doesn't make such an exciting game, and I'm not sure if people would buy tickets to a COVID-19 game. Zombies or giant lobsters are more fun, but if you wanted to run something that would get everyone aware of what everyone else would have to do in a crisis, and you know what the contending demands are on time and attention, and what some of the problems are, it's really useful. You know, one of the things that Atlantic Grim highlighted is it's kind of hard to get stuff to Newfoundland.
Who knew? Who saw that coming?
No, I mean, in that game, the Van Dues out of Canadian Forces bases Valcartier, in order to get armor to Newfoundland quickly, had to drive all the way through Quebec, through New Brunswick, through Nova Scotia, up to Cape Breton, and hop on a ferry. Because we don't have the airlift capacity to actually move any significant amount of armor, probably none at all, to Newfoundland. And otherwise, Newfoundland's got nothing. You know, it's got nothing in terms of kinetic ability.
Please tell me folks had figured that out ahead of time, though. I mean, well, geography's not a secret. You can look at a map and...
We're not worried about, you know, an invasion of Newfoundland, fortunately. But, you know, all our capacity there during the Cold War was anti-submarine warfare. We've got even less now. So the Canadian Forces units in Newfoundland, for the most part, aren't armed, right? Because they're search and rescue.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's nothing there. There's a few reserve units, Canadian Rangers, which are not like U.S. Rangers. They're scouts. They're people with what used to be Lee Enfield rifles. We've just updated them, who go around on snowmobiles in the north. So, yeah, Newfoundland is woefully unprepared for a giant lobster, I'm telling you.
I think if a giant lobster showed up and asked for Newfoundland, wouldn't half of Canada just sort of shrug and go, yeah, sure, whatever?
That's certainly how the Newfoundland players felt during the game. Ironically, that was not true of Saint-Pierre-Miquelon, which is the little French islands just off the coast of Newfoundland, because the French reinforced them like hell. So there was a fortress Saint-Pierre-Miquelon, because the French do have quite an impressive ability to project military hardware around the world. So we ended up with this little fortress Saint-Pierre off the coast of Newfoundland.
And the folks in Newfoundland wondering why they can't all fit on that island, huh?
Well, there was a complicated issue over whether Canada would give the French military permission to operate in Canada. There were, you know, complicated issues about letting go around your country. So that did not get fully resolved in a timely fashion.
Was there any fear that too much military hardware on the island would cause it to tip over and capsize?
No, I mean, literally their main concern. You see, there's an enormous amount of electrical power that feeds a good portion of the grid, not only in Atlantic Canada, but in eastern United States, that's produced in Labrador. Right. And it goes down electrical lines which run to Newfoundland and then across to Nova Scotia and then through New Brunswick and then down into Maine and the eastern United States, and a second major line that runs through Quebec and then on to the United States. The problem is the Lobster, which feeds off electricity, just essentially walked along the giant transmission line and fed on electricity the whole time. So
sounds like a smart move on the Lobster's part.
Yeah, Newfoundland, if you're an energy eating giant monster, Newfoundland is like a giant smorgasbord.
Smart Lobster.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've had a little bit of trouble actually engaging the Canadian forces to get people here. It was a certain irony. We actually had more American military personnel playing or watching than we did Canadian, because we run into this problem of, I don't know how to process this, or is this serious enough, or, you know, does the request have to go through chain of command? Who has to sign off to joining in? So it was a little bit of frustration there with parts of the Canadian forces, because we were essentially saying, hey, come look, see what we're doing. We can run this for you guys. It's for reserve units. You can send people. It's a bit stupid that the U.S. Army War College sends an entire delegation and I can't get anyone out of the local reserve brigade equivalent to National Guard formation in Montreal to come. But anyway, that's another story.
Guys that could commute to it won't bother, huh?
Yeah, well, we'll walk to it. Literally, in some cases, walk to it, because we were playing in the middle of downtown Montreal. I think there were some people who were just a little uncomfortable with it looking unusual. Not that was in Defense Research and Development. It was Canada. It was great. We had people from the Wargaming Cell at the Joint Warfare Center who were great, but there were people who should be there who were running into chain of command issues.
I got to ask, since you were doing this in Montreal, did you make all the announcements in both English and French?
Okay, well, you see, in the full zombie game, we didn't run the Quebec version part of the game the last time we ran it, but we ran it at McGill. There was both Quebec and Ontario, and I took a rather sovereigntist, nationalist group of students and former students and made them Quebec for the primary purpose of making sure that there was a lot of federal, provincial, and Quebec-Ontario rivalry. So there's a certain amount of social engineering in player assignment. So one of the things I want is federal, provincial tension. And yeah, we run the game in English at McGill. There's a group that runs Mega Games in Montreal in French, but we certainly built that in the sort of linguistic political tension tensions into the game, and they came out very well. One of the other things we did, the last two Mega Games, just terrific, the ones at Montreal, is we actually set up a CBC studio in a separate room with live broadcast into the main game room. So the main game room is, you know, a ballroom, has 100 people playing it, 120, but, you know, it's one of these ballrooms that sits 700, 800. It's like a former hotel ballroom. But we had two giant floor-to-ceiling projection screens, and we could break into live CBC coverage with a crawl along the bottom. They had a studio set up. They were doing interviews and everything. They had the music intro and everything. So that was pretty awesome. When we needed to do CBC news reports, we could literally switch to them live and interrupt the game and broadcast it from a studio that was essentially just down the hall.
We managed to sneak in something similar into some of the Gemstone games we did with the National Defense University, but we weren't doing live broadcasts. They would hammer together some recordings overnight and then put them in the next morning's update for all the participants. Because the Gemstone exercise wasn't a giant one-day thing. It spread across 4.5 days of gameplay, so we had an overnight to be able to make some of those adjustments. We also would sneak in a couple of almost web news story graphics where we'd have the picture of something that happened with the caption underneath, and we would include those with a mocked up web page for some news stuff. What turned out to be really fun in one of those games was we had the scenario was in Colombia, and the guys playing the Op 4 were prior Colombian graduates of the program that we were there doing this for. It was the International Counterterrorism Fellows Program. at the NDU. So it was folks who, it was, again, an international program. Out of a class of, say, 80, you'll have maybe 10 Americans in there. Everybody else is from overseas. And so they brought back a handful of the Colombian alumni of this program to be the Op 4, who were playing essentially the FARC and the AUC in all of this. Not that the FARC and the AUC were cooperating, but they had both of them as Op 4 cells in the game. And at one point, the FARC guys wanted to make their own video that they were rebroadcasting. That was kind of like, you know, the video drop that the newspaper picks up that's got the guys making some grand revolutionary proclamation on it or whatever. And so we ended up having to use, we couldn't find any other camera that we could use because all of them were in use doing other things. So we ended up recording it using the QuickTime player on my personal laptop. And I've got like these 10 Colombian guys behind me as I'm trying to hold the laptop up to get them all in frame on the camera that's built into the laptop. Hearing these guys talk and give their speech and the way they were acting in that video, I'm really convinced that some of those guys, that was not the first time they'd made one of those. And that this was probably the first time they'd made one in jest. But I'm pretty sure that some of these dudes had done these before.
Yeah, I mean, when we ran the Apocalypse North at the Diefenbunker here in Ottawa at the beginning of the month, we couldn't do the CBC studio just because the IT infrastructure in there wouldn't support it. But we got to use the actual PA system. Now this was, you know, the nuclear command bunker for the Canadian government up until the 1990s. A lot of the stuff is still original, you know, the original furniture, the prime minister's bed is still there. And they gave us, even though it was an active museum while we were playing, so people were coming in and out, viewing it as a museum, they gave us control of the PA. So we had our game announcements going through the bunker, much as announcements of nuclear detonations in Vancouver or Toronto would have gone through the bunker. And our map room was actually the map room used for plotting strikes and fallouts. And the federal briefing room was the federal briefing room. You know, so they're sitting in tiered seating with the original sort of little plastic signs in front of them that were first put in front of them in the 1960s. It was a very cool place to run a game. It was just awesome. And these confused tourists wandering through the bunker to see 56 people running around trying to deal with the zombie apocalypse was quite funny.
I think if you can run a game in a good locale like that, there's definitely something to it that gives it a little more heft than just a hotel ballroom or, you know, whatever classrooms you've got available at your local school. You always see the things about the guys running role-playing games in a castle in Europe, and you're like, man, that would be cool.
Yeah, it was, and terrific staff. They were just super helpful.
Did they contact you, or did you call them?
They run the Ottawa Mega Games Group, who, frankly, we help them out, and they help us out, so we're kind of combined. They had run one game there before, and I had said after I ran Apocalypse North at McGill, you know, I'd like to run it in Ottawa because, you know, it takes me months to design and put a mega game together, and I don't want to run it just once. So I said, you know, let's get into a pattern of running the game first in McGill and then a smaller version in Ottawa, you know, half a year to a year later. So they had run one previous game there, but it was a terrific space. It was just an excellent space. If it wasn't for the fact that we're all in lockdown right now, I want to talk to them about running some games up there regularly as a sort of, because it's a you know, non-profit community run museum, just as an additional attraction. It's an awesome, awesome place to run games and the stuff. I mean, they're literally letting us move stuff. So, you know, normally when you're in a museum, you're not allowed to move the displays, but, you know, here we are saying, okay, let's move that original 1970s Fallout display over there so that we can put this map on this table here. It was a bit weird to be actually moving the stuff that was there from the time it was an active Canadian Forces Base CARP. When I was in the reserve, some of my unit had worked through there. You know, until the mid-90s, it was a CFB, it was a Canadian Forces Base.
I guess the good piece of moving something that hasn't moved since the 70s is that the hole in the accumulated dust tells you exactly where to put it back, doesn't it?
Well, you'll appreciate this. One of the reasons they still have some of the fixtures is when the base was decommissioned and they brought in contractors to empty it out, the contractors missed some stuff. because it is really, it's you know, it's got like 300 rooms. It's huge. And so they missed some of the rooms. And so when the community took it over as a museum, they started opening it all up again. They said, oh, there's a whole pile of stuff in here that got left behind. So that's some of the stuff there is there because it never got decommissioned properly.
Yeah, when we were closing down one of the bases when I was on active duty, 20 odd years ago at this point, we were closing down one of the bases. And, you know, when you close down a base, you've got to ship everything out. Everything leaves. And some of them were going to various different places, wherever they were off to. But one of the things that's a real pain in the butt to account for and to move out is the shop kit for the maintenance shop for the wheeled vehicle maintenance guys. Because it is essentially like, if you go into your local auto repair place, it's every tool that they've got in there. But of course, this being the military, everything is accounted for by item, and you've got to add all that stuff up. And we did the full layout. Every time we'd done a change of command, you do the inventory, everything's there, everybody's happy. Nobody cares if you have extra stuff. Yeah. When you close a unit, suddenly people care if you have extra stuff because it's all got to leave. It's all got to go somewhere. And you're not just taking it home. So we did the full layout on the shop kit common number 2. I mean, this is, I don't know, 700-800 pieces of equipment. And we did the full layout on the whole thing. We accounted for the whole thing. We said, all right, good. That's that. Let's move that out of the way. Okay, what else is in the tool room? And we started laying all that stuff out. We were about 40 pieces short of a second full common number 2 off the books. We could open a second auto repair shop. And so, yeah, your point is well taken that when you start closing things down and decommissioning things and moving things out, it's amazing how much stuff you find that you've accumulated over the years.
Yeah.
I would think especially in like a nuclear bunker where you don't have people just wandering through there very often.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you know, it's I won't say it's a maze, but I mean, there are a lot of little rooms to open up and say, oh, look, there's stuff too. So yeah. So thank goodness. I mean, it's remarkably intact. Cool place. So anyone's ever in Ottawa, it's about 20 minutes drive west of Ottawa, Carp, Ontario, designed to take 10 megatons a mile away. A very, very cool little museum in a really cute little town.
The mega games, we've talked some about a couple of the different ones that you've done. I know you had done one at Connections UK a year or two ago, because I remember the pictures of Brian Train as one of the leaders in one of the leader cells. Can you tell us a little bit about that mega game?
Well, I mean, they've often run mega games in Connections UK as part of the program, often on the first day. You're probably talking about Dire Straits, which was set in a near future with the Trump administration having to deal with multiple simultaneous East-Southeast Asian crises. So things happening in the Korean Peninsula, dispute in the South China Sea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that game, we run that twice. We run that both at King's College London as part of Connections UK. We ran that one year at McGill as the McGill Mega Game. I think the KCL run was my favorite one. That was cool. That modeled a somewhat disorganized White House, to put it delicately, which I must say was one of my favorite sub games ever that I've ever designed, and I think turned out to be remarkably accurate. But that was an interesting game.
Plus, the idea of Brian Train hamming it up is not very far beyond the pale.
Well, there. I mean, this goes to show that big games are where they depart from regular games. Because if you've seen that picture, Brian Train is sitting in front of a giant complex display which represents every major power center in the North Korean regime, because he was the great leader, and has pawns on it which different players own and so forth. And it looks super sophisticated. That was a bit of a stage prop, because we built this beautiful-looking game of North Korea, but it had no actual rules. The purpose was that other players would walk past the North Korean table and stare at this arrangement of pawns and try to work out what it meant in terms of the internal North Korean power structure, but it didn't actually mean anything.
Yeah.
So it was a visually very impressive game, and it was largely their players who'd be staring at it trying to work out who was up and down, sort of capture that what the hell is going on in North Korea? I mean, we had in our mind that if there was something happened in North Korea, there was a power struggle, we had enough game pieces there, we could quickly invent a game. But mostly it was to confuse the other players about what was going on in North Korea. And it worked quite well because it looks quite impressive on the table in front of them, but it was largely a prop and less so a game mechanism that we were using, although we had it as a standby mechanism if there'd been a coup or something.
Maskarovka.
Yeah. In that game, there was no President Trump. President Trump was a sub-game in which the White House advisors were all trying to influence him. And most of the players in the main room never realized that there wasn't a President Trump because he would tweet. And we'd put it on Twitter. But they didn't realize that he wasn't actually a player. He was a board game in which people were trying to influence him in various directions.
And of course, all informed by, you know, the outsider perspective of what's happening here in the U.S.
Well, you know, if, for those of you watching the White House COVID-19 press conferences, you'd recognize a certain similarity in terms of messaging and themes and language and what have you. I actually ran a after that game, I took the North Korea tweets that the game had produced, the board game had produced essentially, and compared them with actual Trump tweets in the 3 months after the game, and they were 85% overlap in terms of what the president actually said in the 3 months after the game and what the president had said, what the board game had generated as the president saying during the game. So I was quite pleased with that actually.
So we've talked a bunch about some of the mega games that are kind of modern or near future, or in some cases slightly wacky sci-fi influenced sorts of things. You did mention the Iran-Iraq game, which I got it like 40 years ago and all, but still post-Vietnam, which many of the war gamers at least would consider to be relatively modern. I've seen stuff online with some mega games that were played during World War II, for instance. What are some of the historical mega games that have been out there that folks might have seen or futzed around with or that you might have been involved in?
Well, I mean, I haven't. I mean, the ones that we've run at McGill have all been future or current or near future. I run a big peace building simulation at McGill, which is kind of a mega game that I've been running for almost 20 years. Again, it's current. I mean, people have done various World War II campaigns. You know, Arnhem lends itself very well because you have sort of multiple maps going on at the landing zones and relief column. People have done 19th century diplomacy games around the Napoleonic Wars, which again lend themselves well to that kind of mixed Paul Mill stuff. I think, I mean, the general sense, and I think in the mega gaming community, is that the historical games do not pull out the same size of audience. Because one of the things that happens with a mega game is we're typically reaching a much broader audience than just war gamers. We have people come out who are gamers, but are not necessarily war gamers. They might be Euro gamers or what have you, because the game mechanisms are relatively light. We have people whose interest is model UN, those kinds of things, who come out because there's a lot of negotiation in the games. Typically, when we run a game, they're somewhere between 20% and 30% female, as opposed to the 1% in the war gaming hobby. And I think that also highlights and much younger demographic. Now, I run them at a university, but I would say that's generally true of most mega games. So people I've never run a historical game. I don't think I'd actually get a big crowd out for a historical game at McGill. I think these are the kinds of topics that people are most likely to come out for. And the only historical game I've ever played in is actually the Iran-Iraq one. Although I must say, I rarely play them. I'm almost always on the game design or control side of the table.
Yeah, the downside of being the guy organizing and, helping control the games is you never get to play in these things. So
I enjoy controlling them. It's a real sense of you've got somewhere between 50 to 120 people and you're trying to make it all come off so that they feel immersed and they feel excited and everyone keeps busy. Which is one problem in a mega game is keeping everyone equally busy, right? I mean, if in a two-sided game, you have the same cognitive workload on both sides of the table. In a multi-sided 120, 150 player game with different people doing different things in subgames, it is a real challenge to make sure that someone doesn't get super bored, that their part of the game doesn't go so easily that they feel bored or that their game doesn't become so difficult that they lose interest. And we don't do it perfectly. There's going to be some bright spots, but we try to design game mechanisms that are going to make sure that everyone feels challenged all the time. So that is probably the biggest challenge in a mega game is it's like a Swiss clock. There's a lot of moving pieces, but you really got to monitor every piece, which is why we have a lot of people in the control team running sub games. And if someone says this is not running well, or this is too easy, or this is too hard, we've got to make on the fly modifications to the game in order to keep them equally challenged.
I remember an Army Sergeant Major at one of the big event games like that I was part of the white cell, the control cell, sort of joking about it, because they were done with their part of the tasking, but they hadn't submitted it yet. And I knew that because I'd just been walking around talking with folks, just checking on some of the things that were happening. And I was like, you guys are done. Why haven't you turned all your stuff in yet? And they said, you know, the guy looked at me, he's like, sir, I learned a long time ago that if you're ahead of schedule on the exercise and you turn your stuff in, they just give you more stuff to do to keep you busy. I'm fine not being busy. And in the context of a mega game, obviously you wouldn't want that because you want the participants engaged the full time. You want them to get their money's worth. But
people pay $20 or $40 for tickets, so they don't want to be sitting around for an hour and a half with them.
Yeah, exactly.
The problem can run the other way. They don't want to, you don't want to lose control of the game in the way that players can't win. I mean, no one wants to sit for 7 hours in a ballroom with 100 people and face an unwinnable game because, you know, something went wrong at the beginning or the game is badly designed. So it's a bit like running a D&D game. You know, one of the reasons, of course, that dungeon masters have that shield in front of them so you can't see the die rolls is so they can fudge the dice rolls.
Yes.
They need to. The dragon actually wiped out your entire party. But that's going to ruin the evening. So, the DM rolls the 20 and says, oh, we missed. Because, you know, at that point, the narrative engagement and the fun would be ruined by having the party all wiped out. So we've got to learn to kind of fudge the game to keep it challenging but not impossible.
Yes. Yeah. I wonder, you mentioned not a lot of folks involved in sort of the historical wargaming aspects of things. I wonder if there aren't some historical events that weren't necessarily combat heavy that might make for an engaging mega game. You mentioned some of the diplomacy stuff, at that very high level. I'm wondering if there aren't some economic focused ones, sort of the robber barons competing to build industrial America in the late 1800s kind of springs to mind with Carnegie and Morgan and all these guys, Rockefeller running around, almost economic warfare, in a sense, but if there are other similar things, it's tough to do the rise of Prussia without somebody shooting somebody else, but other similar economic focused games, if there wouldn't be something around the British East India Company or something similar that you could do historical, but not necessarily combat.
Yeah. I mean, there are games that are, the Arenarak game, it's Ben Moore's game. We've got a discussion of it on PAX, in terms of his design of it. It is overwhelmingly a kinetic game. It was a great game. I enjoyed it. There's some politics in that as well. So, I mean, you can run those games. I think there's loads of Paul Mill topics, which are partly diplomatic and partly sort of campaigning, which can work. Obviously, I think that, it depends on who your audience is. So if you're running a mega game at a wargaming convention, or you're running it with military folks, or that's your potential audience, you're going to get a different buy-in. I run games at a university campus in which, the interests are slightly different. When you're doing these things, you're forking out a few thousand dollars for hall rentals. You gotta make sure you sell. I mean, we don't make any money, right? I mean, it's non-profit, but we don't make any money. But if we're $1,000 short, that's out of my pocket. So
yeah. Would rather not do that.
So the spouse has made it very clear that, that we should go for a popular mega game topic. So they'll leave us subsidizing rental of an entire floor of a large building.
Yeah, no kidding.
So there's that too. And there's been some, but you could use them. You could use them for everything. I mean, you can do chain of command. You can do tensions, you could do coalition behavior. Those things all work out well in a mega game. You want something where there are, I think, points of friction, where there's challenges of cooperation. Obviously, adversary relationships are fine too, but you don't want everything on the blue side, or for that matter, the red side, to all run perfectly smoothly. So anything where you can have, you know, fights over resources, fights over campaign strategy, you know, inter-service rivalries or disagreements, that military political campaign would make a potentially good mega game.
When you do this at the university, is it? I know you do your Republic of Brynania thing as part of one of your classes, but are the mega games that you're doing at McGill built into the class, or is that just an extracurricular thing just for kicks?
So I teach two courses in this term. Unfortunately, there's no Civil War in Brynania this year. It got canceled when the university shut down for 2 weeks because of coronavirus. I teach two courses this term. One is a course on peace operations, and one is a course on game design. It's a conflict simulation course. Both of those courses have class participation graded components, in which there's a great many things they can do that count. But amongst them is playing in the mega game because it's relevant to both courses, because one course deals with emergency management and humanitarian and insurgency and blah, blah, blah. And the other course deals with game design. So I have a system where amongst the many things you can do for credit is take part in the mega game, but you don't have to. Perfectly, there's lots of other stuff you can do to get yourself an A, and I do get, you know, a lot of students playing, and then fortunately from the game design class, a lot of them actually sign up to help run the game. So we had a terrific control team this year for Atlantic Rim, and most of them were students in my conflict simulation course.
You had mentioned no Civil War in Brynania because of the school shutting down, and I was actually thinking about this before you had mentioned that, you know, weren't able to do that stuff online. I wonder how well a distributed mega game through some sort of online channel might work, particularly given current global circumstances. But do you know if anybody's tried some sort of online digitally mediated mega game? Is that 150 people would be really tough to wrangle, particularly with all the sub games going on like you talked about. But I wonder how easy or tough that might be to try to pull together.
It depends on the game design. So Brynania, the peacebuilding simulation, got canceled this year, not because I couldn't run it online. Actually, I could run it online. I absolutely can run it. A lot of it is online to begin with. I mean, they meet in person, but a lot of it is online. The problem there was that the university wasn't a problem. The university shut down for 2 weeks.
Yeah, you ran out of time.
Teaching activity. For a very good reason, and that is our students are from all over the world, and right now they're desperately, you know, trying to work out where they're going to be and how they're going to get home. And the university felt, even if you can do activities during 2 weeks, please just give students 2 weeks to sort out their lives, and then we will start again on March 30th with online activity. So I could have absolutely run that. When I run it, I have people playing who aren't at McGill. I have people playing from all over the world, often former students in supporting roles. So if you design it from the bottom up as an online game, yeah. I mean, in an age of online chat groups and email and Skype and what have you, Zoom, you absolutely could run. And that's a mega game on a mega game, because that is 7 days of 100 people.
Yeah,
or
wow.
12 hours a day. I mean, that's... You know, that's beyond what any rational person would normally want to do in a mega game. So if it's designed from the beginning, you absolutely can do it, but it has to be designed from the beginning. And there's lots of, you know, free tech out there that, you know, you don't really need a dedicated platform, because there's all kinds of ways in which people can communicate, including good old email, which works perfectly excellent.
Yeah.
And has the advantage that people actually have to put things down in writing, as they do in the real world, to make things happen. Now, in terms of distributed games, Urban Nightmare, which is a Jim Wallman game. Jim Wallman is the great mega game guru in the UK. He already had a zombie apocalypse game called Urban Nightmare. And a few years ago, he ran it as a distributed game. So we were playing real games, but we were playing them in, I think, 11 locations in 4 countries, all at the same time, all linked together, so that what was happening in one game would affect what was happening in other games. We ran a small version of that in Montreal as part of that. We had an awesome, you know, there were some teething issues, and I know Jim was a bit frustrated with that after the fact, because some of the games, I think he found it difficult not to be there for 11 different games. So some of the games went in directions which were not what his design had in his head intended, but that worked. So that was multiple live mega games linked, digitally, but certainly with Brinania, half to two thirds of the game is online to begin with. And so all I would be doing is cutting out the face to face meetings. These are university students. They have 52 different ways of communicating digitally. as a matter of deliberate policy, I have never tried to move it onto a platform. I mean, we have course support software, blah, 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 blah. I don't need to. You know, these folks can find a way of communicating with each other. They're carrying around smartphones with 12 or 13 redundant communication systems built into them. So the only thing I have to do is say, no matter how you communicate, I need a copy of it. So,
yeah,
you
know, yeah.
If you're a chat group, you got to invite me in, or you've got to cut and paste me the transcript. If you have a Skype conversation, you've got to send me a summary of the meeting, because the white cell has to know what everyone is doing. But beyond that, I set no rules. Last year, I was simultaneously in 42 Facebook chat groups as I ran the game, because they all would set them up for different subtopics and different things. So I was literally, I'm reading email, I'm sending email out, and down the side of my, well, multiple screens, because I have multiple screens for that, I'm trying to monitor 42 separate Facebook chat groups. So
that could all go live at any given moment.
Yeah, you can run a mega game, you know, distributed, provided what you don't want to do is make it so complicated that people don't know what to do. Because in a real mega game, they walk up to you and say, I don't understand this, or how would I do this, or can I do that? And that is something you lose in a distributed environment. People feel a bit isolated. You know, where do they go if they don't understand something? So there, I think you want to make it pretty free Kriegspiel. Brinania is a lot of sort of I decide stuff. I've got algorithms, but the players don't need to see that. They just need to tell me what they're doing, and it ought to be realistic because they've just taken a whole course on this stuff. That is a lot easier for them than them trying to master a bunch of rules and trying to make sure that 100 people simultaneously understand a written rule set. I mean, how many of us, when we unbox a new war game, play it right the first time?
There's a great story of me and my son when he was about six, and Jim Snyder, Captain Darwin from our forums, but also Jim Snyder from On Target Sims, the Flashpoint Campaigns guys. We actually managed to mess up Kids of Carcassonne the first time we played it out of the box. I mean, this is a game designed to be played by six-year-olds, and we screwed it up out of the box. So I'm totally in tune with that.
You read the rules quickly, you play the game, you read the rules again, and you go, oops, oh, that's how that was supposed to work, right? So that's how we all of us wargamers actually work. You almost always mess the game up the first time. I mean, how many times do you watch someone who's done a video playthrough and they'll be a little bit saying, this isn't the way the rule was supposed to work? So what you don't want to do in a distributed game in which it's a one-shot game, right? You know, they're not going to come back and replay it for you, is you do not want things that are going to be misunderstood. If you were running a distributed mega game, on the player end, even if you have rules for yourself, even if you've got CRTs and what have you, the less the players have to see and worry about, the more it's kind of plain language instruction, the better the game will run, because you won't be trying to, you know, deal with a bunch of stressed out players trying to understand a written rule set, or misunderstand a written rule set, or engaged in rules lawyering and what have you. So we should be, if you're going to do it, you know, make sure from the player point of view, it's really, really accessible.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. In some of the professional development stuff that I've done for folks talking about integrating games into the classroom and using games as a teaching tool, one of the points that we always make is, you don't have to have the kids sitting around the board, because a lot of the stuff that I teach is aimed at middle and high school teachers learning how to do this. And what I tell them is, don't give the kids the rule book. Don't have the kids sitting around the board. Have the kids tell you what decisions they want to make. And as a part of the learning effect, like, explain why they're making these decisions or what they think they're going to gain out of these decisions. But then you do the adjudication and tell them the outcomes. Don't have them look over your shoulder as you're metaphorically rolling the dice or whatever other adjudication mechanism you have. Have them tell you what decision they want to make. and then you adjudicate it and give them the outcome and make it a black box to the participants. Now, it needs to be a relatively consistent black box as much as possible, but that gets out of the rules lawyering, right? That gets out of the overanalyzing of, well, if I stack this one extra asset here, then that gives us a plus six bonus to accomplish. Nah, get out of that stuff. Tell me what decision you want to make and explain to me your rationale for it so I understand the learning process. And then I'll tell you what the outcome is.
Yeah, so you know, similarly in Aftershock, which is, as you know, it's an emergency management game. It's a humanitarian assistance game. It's a board game. We never give the players the... If we do, they start freaking out about the rules or they're trying to look things up. We just tell them, okay, this is, you know, here's the turn sequence. The other thing we say is, you know, follow through the turn sequence. This point in the turn sequence, here are the decisions you've got to make. You know, do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? Do you want to do this? This is what the rules will allow you to do. And we just explain it to them as they reach each decision point on what it is they can do. Never give them the rules. I'm telling you, 15, 20 minutes into the, usually 15 minutes into a standard game, they've learned all the rules without ever knowing they've learned the rules.
Yeah.
By talking them through the decision choices and not introducing a rule until it becomes relevant. So, you know, there's a rule for security operations. Until there's social unrest in the game, it's pointless knowing the rule because you're not going to use it. There are certain things you can do in the late game once the situation is stabilized. Why worry them about that until you get to the late game? They don't need to know. It has no bearing on the decisions they make. So, yeah, you've got to... And so getting back to our original point, if you're going to run a distributed mega game on something like a global pandemic or anything else for that matter, keep it rules light from the player's point of view. It doesn't mean there aren't rules. For Brinania, I have a really complicated Excel spreadsheet that models about 8 variables and comes up with, you know, indicator of humanitarian conditions in 52 regions of the country. But they don't need to know that. They just need to know. They just need to know what they're doing, and I will worry about what the spreadsheet is doing, and I will give them the result. And yeah.
I got to ask your complicated Brinania spreadsheet. Was that developed before or after Ellie Bartels walked you through the gemstone model?
Separately, yeah. It was before.
Kind of in parallel.
There were things I wanted to get at. So that models, you know, for population displacement, road access, local security, level of destruction, effectiveness of aid program, amount of money being spent, blah, 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 blah. But they don't, if I showed them that, they'd start metagaming the spreadsheet. I don't want them. I want them to think about, what are the humanitarian challenges in different parts of the country? How can I access those areas? What are the trade-offs? How am I going to triage, given that I've got scarce resources and a lot of need? I don't want them thinking about, you know, which cell has the most effect on. I don't want them mini-maxing.
Yeah.
I want them thinking through the actual kinds of decisions that the organizer would face with a humanitarian disaster.
So, yeah, we wouldn't even put the model on the screen until the last day of the gemstone exercises.
Yeah, in real life, you don't get it. So, I mean, this is the problem right now with COVID-19. We do have some pandemic modeling, but it's not as if people know how much closing down California or New York will actually reduce community transmission, right? I mean, so why give them those rules?
Yeah.
In real life, no one has those. People have a rough model, and that's great. I'll give them a rough model too, but no one's giving anyone the rules to COVID-19 right now. So if I'm training people... If I'm teaching people about the real world, I want it to look a lot like the real world. So, and I actually had a student who's currently working in local government in California tweet this morning, coincidentally, about how useful doing the sim years ago at McGill was for thinking about what she's currently dealing with in her small town in California in terms of COVID-19 response. So that's the ultimate gratifying thing. Literally this morning when someone's saying, you know, looking back at my college days, I did the sim I'm facing right now.
Yeah. to kind of wrap things up a little bit and put a bow on them here, as we're recording this, right, it's towards the latter part of March. Obviously, somebody finding this a year and a half from now will, I hope, find the discussion interesting, but what I'm about to ask you will be completely irrelevant to them. But what are some of the mega games that are planned? And I'm careful to say planned because things being what they are, we have no idea if you'll actually be able to pull them off 3 months or 6 months from now, but do you have anything planned out there in the mega game space? And if a random participant wanted to show up and play somebody and be a part of this, how do they engage with that?
Well, I mean, first of all, if you go online, there are a number of places on the web, on Facebook, Mega Game Makers and so forth, in which people announce forthcoming games all over the world. So, you know, right now, as you know, there pretty much all suspended until we work out what's happening with the pandemic and we can meet in groups again. But there's normally there's a lot of activity, particularly in the UK, but in the US to a smaller extent, in Canada and in the rest of Europe and elsewhere. Our plan for next year, so our 2 years ago, our game was set in Quebec and Ontario. This year, our game was set in Atlantic Canada. Next year, we want to set our game in Western Canada, partly because my colleague Tom Fisher produces these absolutely beautiful maps, which we print on vinyl so we can reuse them over and over again, sort of area movement maps. And we want to make sure we get a full set for Canada so that we can then run any game that involves populated areas of Canada. So we need a Western Canadian game so that you can complete the set. And then we have games for, we have map, giant maps for everywhere. I mean, these get, 6 foot long, 4 foot, 5 foot wide maps. So what we're currently thinking for next year, and I have to say we always change our minds, is having done zombies in Ontario and Quebec and having done giant monsters in Atlantic Canada, we're thinking of going underground and essentially doing Tremors in Western Canada, the movie Tremors, giant outbreak of huge underground worms. Because that'll allow us to do a Western Canada game and get all the game infrastructure so we have the maps so that we can use them over again for future games. Nice emergency management game, sort of interesting dynamics. But that may well change because usually we decide on a topic and then we end up changing it. And of course, we don't know when we're going to be running mega games again. So at this point, we've got other things to think about, like do we have enough toilet paper? We do, by the way. I say that, but... I went grocery shopping a couple of days ago and they had freshly baked cheese bread and live lobsters in my local grocery store. So I'm thinking, okay, at least where I am, the apocalypse is not so bad yet.
You're again, as I have frequently referred to on the podcast, you're also north of the wall.
Yeah.
By quite a margin.
Yes, and we've closed the wall to you guys. Sorry, you can't come in now. So
totally understandable. For folks that are interested in mega games, you're going to have to do a little bit of poking around online. We've included some of the links on this podcast episode, so you'll be able to click through a couple of those. Obviously, with the caveat of God only knows when we're going to be able to get these started again. I think it would be pretty interesting that if you guys get the hankering to try one of these things online, even at a smaller scale, send up a flare because we probably have folks that would be interested in at least participating. We've been running a couple of different online Kriegspiels, using our forums just to sort of keep players informed. Obviously, we don't have the gameplay in the forums because then everybody would be able to see what everyone else is doing. And that's kind of antithetical to the point of a Kriegspiel. The guys are using the Kriegspiel forums just to let folks know, hey, everybody get your stuff in. I'm about to flip the next turn. And they're emailing all the traffic back and forth that would normally be message traffic, scratched on notepads in real life. This is the second and third times we've done this. We did one, at our previous location that ran about 18 months. We're about a year each into the two that are running in parallel right now. They've been going for quite a while and getting close to wrapping up. And then afterwards, Jim and Doug will pop on and give us sort of the after action. Hey, here's what happened. Here's how it happened. Here's what went on, that are pretty interesting. But we've got guys that are already sort of used to this sort of limited information, distributed, long-term kind of game like this. So if somebody gets a hankering for trying to do something like that, please let us know because we've got guys that are already doing it sort of.
Yeah, so. And it's much closer to the way it actually works, right?
Yes.
information is flowing through messages, emails, couriers, depending on what historical period we're talking about. So, the odd thing is that, if it forces us to do more distributed gaming, we're actually getting back to something that more accurately models command and control in large, complex organizations, which is not a bunch of people standing around talking to each other.
Yeah, it's not putting everybody on the same floor of a hotel ballroom. And it may be very realistic given the fact that nobody's supposed to be going outside right now, so we all have to use electronic communication. So you've got that as well. So look, we're not recording this on our usual weekday evening, so thank you for giving up a little bit of your weekend to join us and talk about this one. We greatly appreciate it, especially since you're sort of letting us get a peek behind the curtain of Canadian planning for the inevitable American refugee tidal wave that's going to hit,
We're ready. After two mega games, we're ready for you.
Yeah. If we bring a giant rock lobster who eats electricity, maybe not so much.
Yeah, that's a problem.
So that's the siege engine we need. We need the giant rock lobster.
Giant rock lobsters.
There we go. Rex, thank you. Stay safe up there. Appreciate you joining us, and we'll look for more mega game traffic as you share it.
Always great talking.
Great, thank you.